I was taken thither by a man who during life had been a great mental specialist. The building was placed amid the most beautiful surroundings, which seemed to breathe an atmosphere of peace and rest. I mentioned this impression to my friend the doctor, who replied, "Quite so, quiet, soothing surroundings are the first essentials for dealing with any kind of mental disorder." The gardens surrounding the hospital contained broad stretches of lawn interspersed with beautiful woods, and everywhere the soft notes of rippling or falling water were faintly audible. Ever and anon through the trees I caught the glint of water tinged with the evening glow which is ever present here. Amid these woods, walking about the lawns and boating on the lakes, I saw many of the patients. Passing along a handsome avenue, we at length came in sight of the hospital. It was a splendid building in the Renaissance style, with verandas along the front, and was surrounded upon all sides by velvety lawns and flower beds. Numerous basins with fountains playing and statues of various kinds decorated the lawns. A woman, seated on a low stool, was playing a harp, while reclining on couches round her were many patients of both sexes. We passed into the building itself, and I found that in some ways the institution was arranged on similar lines to those of the houses of refuge in hell. Thus there was a secondary school attached, and most of the patients attended the school as part of their course of treatment. Further, there were concert halls and a theatre, chapels for several different religious bodies, an art gallery, and so forth. My medical friend explained, "One of our chief objects is to divert the mind of the patients from too much concentration upon themselves. Many were very selfish or at any rate self-centered folk. Religious mania or excessive grief is likewise the cause of many of these cases being here. Wholesome, soothing amusements, which will dispel the morbid trait in their characters, are therefore of the greatest value. As to direct treatment, we very largely employ suggestion, hypnotism, and magnetism." See. We entered what on earth would have been called an operating theater. Here, two doctors were busy magnetizing a woman patient. She was stretched on a bed, clad in a plain grayish-white robe drawn in at the waist by a girdle, and similar to the costume they all wear here. One doctor was standing behind her with his hand gently resting on her forehead, while the other stood at her feet, but without touching her. Both men seemed to be concentrating their wills on her and gazing into her face. They made no movement or any sign that they were aware of our presence. I was able to perceive that from each there appeared to flow out a kind of faint light, and that this light was being focused, as it were, on her head. We passed into another room where a violin was being played to soothe the man who was tossing in mental distress upon the bed. I said to the doctor, "I notice that here the sexes mix much more than they do round where I dwell." "Not really so. There is very little companionship here between the men and the women. Both, however, are necessary to aid in the work, especially as it found that better results from magnetism are obtained when the operator is of the opposite sex to the patient." We entered a third room and found a hypnotist at work. He was making passes over someone. As soon as he saw us, he bowed and explained that this patient could not eliminate from his mind the remembrances of a terrible accident for which he was to a certain extent responsible. The remembrance of this had turned his brain on earth, and the ill effects were not yet entirely removed from his mind. "I am hypnotizing him for a time, so as to compel him to forget this terrible experience, and so by degrees we shall restore peace to his troubled mind." Leaving him, we passed into a comparatively small room in which was a patient lying on a couch. My medical friend said, "This is a strange case, and shows how strong is the power of the mind and even the remembrance of the body after death. This woman's mental affliction in life took the form of a belief that she was a cripple unable to walk. There was nothing organically wrong, yet by degrees, as this hallucination grew upon her, she became crippled and misshapen even as she is now. Had the disease been a physical one, she would have left it behind her at death, but it is purely a mental one, due to a morbid nature which in life seemed to take a perverted joy in gazing at the misshapen and crippled. This she did not from any motive of sorrow or wish to help the sufferers, but out of a morbid curiosity. For the rest, however, she was neither a total unbeliever nor yet evil by nature. Few cases such as this come to us here. They are, I understand, more common in hell. I, H, J, L, inquired, how do you treat her? Mainly by magnetism and mental suggestion. We are striving to prove to her that her spiritual body need not reproduce the defects of the physical one. Most spirits readily grasp that fact, but her mind has become so overclouded that she cannot as yet grasp it. However, even the most obstinate cases soon yield to treatment here. What does seem to take a long time is the education which is afterwards necessary. We passed through other rooms, through long wards and into lecturums where doctors were giving lectures on medical subjects. I, H, J, L, inquired of my friend whether there was not an operating theater as in an earthly hospital. Oh dear, no, he replied. We have got long past those clumsy methods here. Of course, some operations are required on earth owing to the material nature of a physical body, although there are far more operations than are really necessary. Here, however, the spirit body yields to and needs much subtler methods. The only place you find anything approaching an operating theater is in hell. I shuddered at the horror of the idea underlying those simple words. It would take me too long to give you any further details of this wonderful hospital, but perhaps I should say that I was surprised to find how large a part religious services played in the treatment. We don't attend religious services to any large extent in this realm, that is our principal duty in the next realm, but services formed quite a marked feature of the treatment, I perceived, and in this it approximated to the house of refuge in hell and to the ordinary course of life in the realm of belief without acts. Many of the services, I noticed, had quite an elaborate ritual, and evidently were designed expressly with the object of helping forward the mental healing of the patients who attended. A shadowy prototype on earth was that funny old service of touching and healing in the prayer book in the days of Queen Anne. Outside in the grounds we separated, and after thanking my medical friend, I returned here. Chapter 29, Neither Will They Be Persuaded Though. One Rose from the Dead, J. W. May we publish the names and details for identification given by P. Rhee himself and Barber. H.J.L. With regard to P. and Barber, I think there is no harm in giving the details about the latter. It was meant as a piece of conclusive evidence, and I think most would agree it is. With regard to P., matters are a little different. He feels it rather a hindrance already to keep sufficiently in touch with earth matters to send you his experiences, and does not want to do anything which might draw him back still further into earth conditions. If the details he has given were published, being a well-known man, you would have a number of carping, or at any rate inquisitive, persons constantly sending tests and expecting them to be answered. If P. agreed to answer those tests, he would at once be assailed by further ones. He would be constantly worried by them, and, therefore, dragged back into earth conditions. He wishes to be rid of earth trammels, and, instead, would find he had rebound himself with them. If he refused to answer further tests, people would at once say it was fraud. They would say, here are communications coining through which purport to be from Mr. P., and yet the entity either will not or cannot answer these simple questions as to his earth life. They would refuse to see that it is quite one thing to send a message through dealing with life here and another to put ourselves again in touch with our former earth life. You yourself believe us and do not bother us with unnecessary questions. You have not only had dates and other details of the lives of men quite unknown to you, but have also from W. A. received details of his private life not merely unknown to you, but in a large measure unintelligible even when given. These details have, however, been perfectly plain to M., and have convinced her of his identity, as she herself told you. It is, therefore, not with any wish to avoid giving evidence when the demand is reasonable that I hesitate to request P. to allow the details about him to be published. Talk the matter over with Mr. K., and then consult me again. With regard to Barber, the same objections do not arise. He is not communicating through you, nor do we propose to let him. Neither is he interested in doing so, being otherwise engaged. If, therefore, anyone wanted to cross-question them, he would fail to get any reply, but this could hardly be taken as disproving the reality of our group of spirits. Is the matter now quite plain? J. W. Yes. Still, I am sorry. If P. would agree, it would once and for all decide the question which still vexes people, whether the one identity does survive after death or not. I mean agree to be thoroughly cross-questioned, as you call it. H.J.L. Not a bit of it. Plenty of evidence has been sent through to prove that to any reasonable man. Even what we have given should be sufficient. And there have been still more striking examples where spirits have deliberately thrown back their own progress so as to prove even to the most obstinate unbeliever that there is a personal survival after death. But it is selfish and unreasonable to expect us continually to be doing that sort of thing, I mean delaying our own progress. No, Jack, many people do believe, but it is still true of many men, neither will they be persuaded though one rose from the dead. Now it's time you were off. Next instant I sank into oblivion. J. W. Chapter 30, The Author's Adventure in the Park on the Spirit Plane, Transvision, etc. May 18, 1914. I again saw myself lying asleep on the bed, but this time did not feel nervous. The room seemed to get more and more distant and then grew nebulous. I seemed to be enveloped in a mist, and gradually this mist took shape and form, became solid, and lo, the landscape with which I was now familiar. Before me was stretched a beautiful tract of country bathed in a soft evening light. I floated down onto a grassy hill and saw below me in the valley the town in which H. J. L. now lived. Soon I was able to pick out the roofs of the college and turned my steps in that direction. The route I took led me through a beautiful wood, amid the branches of whose trees birds were singing merrily. As I drew nearer the town I saw the park with statuary and the sculpture gallery which I had seen before. I began to walk through the park, and I noticed how sweetly the flowers smelt. Large numbers of spirits were constantly passing me, and several gazed at me intently, as if they felt I was in some way different. At length two young men stopped and said, "Who are you, and are you dead? You do not look quite like one of us, and yet if you are not dead how come you here?" I replied, "No, I'm not dead, but somehow I have developed in such a way recently since my father-in-law died that I am able to come and visit him here and even carry away a remembrance of what I see." "Well, that's very funny. I wish I'd been able to do that," said one of them, "when I was alive. Can you visit any other planes of existence besides these?" the other inquired. "No," I replied, "but I meet others who have been selected by my father-in-law, and these give me accounts of their experiences in hell and in the plane above this, and also in the astral plane." "You're jolly lucky," the taller of the two, who had spoken first, cried. "We know practically nothing of either hell or the plane above, though, of course, we do know something of the astral plane. You might tell us something about them. Come, let us sit down by this fountain." I sat down with them and had just begun to relate some of the officer's adventures, when I saw H. J. L. hurrying towards me. He was evidently annoyed, and said, "Really, Jack, you ought to have known better than to sit down here chattering when the officer and I are waiting to get to business." The two strangers at once apologized and explained that it was their fault. H. J. L. answered, "That's all very well, and I know you meant no harm. But if you want that sort of information, come to me for it and you shall have it. My nephew's work is to give it to those who are alive on the earth, not to preach to those who, having died, have come here." We then parted, and I went with H. J. L. through the streets, which seemed fairly full of people, into the college. In his room I found the officer waiting, who, having shaken hands, remarked, "If you're not careful, you'll get so fond of this country that you'll not wish to return to your own." He then took up the story of his life on this side of the grave. Chapter 31, The Fate of Children. Transvision and Conversation. May 25, 1914. As in my last vision, I saw the whole landscape on my way to H. J. L., but this time spoke to no one till I was in H. J. L.S. room. As soon as I saw him, I asked, "What is the age limit at which children can enter hell?" I noticed that from the account of the officer there are no children in hell proper, and yet they are to be found in the seventh division of hell. H. J. L. answered, "You cannot, of course, fix any exact age limit. Things work much more reasonably than that. Thus if an infant dies who as yet knows nothing of God, it goes to the infant schools in hell, as you know. If it has acquired a vague idea of God and a future life, it will come to our secondary schools in the realm of half-belief. If it has acquired sufficient knowledge it may go to the college, and, finally, boys and girls who have a real living belief may go direct to the realm above this, or occasionally to the highest plane of all. In these cases they will have to complete their education on the intellectual side, although their spiritual side may be well developed. This is, of course, a reversal of what generally happens here. Usually our intellects have been developed largely at the expense of our spiritual functions. Now let us consider the other side. When a child reaches a certain stage in its development, roughly from 5 to 7, it would ordinarily begin to have some general idea as to right and wrong. Now if a child has been badly brought up, or if it inherits a perverse and evil nature from its ancestors, or if obsessed, it may develop very unpleasant characteristics. It may commit serious offenses, and in general may begin to develop badly. Under these circumstances it is cut off very often at the wish of its guide and transferred to the astral plane. There, clear of many of the surroundings which might have dragged it down, it will have an opportunity of developing and of learning sufficient to enable it on leaving the astral plane to come at least to the realm of half-belief. This period of child life stretches roughly from 5 to 12, but, of course, may vary at either end. The third stage is when they are ceasing to be children and becoming adults, especially in the matter of sex. This is a very critical age, and many children unfortunately choose the downward instead of the upward path. The tendency is still, however, for the final decision to be left for the astral plane, and I must remind you that to a certain extent this is always the case. In the case, however, of an adult hardened in sin, the astral simply continues in its new life, repeating the sins of the former, but a youth who has started on the downward path, being less hardened, is more likely to be checked by the shock of death. Further, he is hardly likely to have had time to drive away his guardian angel in the way that a hardened sinner has. Thus even a thoroughly vicious youth will probably see the folly of his ways as soon as he reaches the astral plane, and the vicious habits, not yet being firmly rooted, will be easier to eradicate. On the other hand, if he rejects this second chance and falls into the type of sins represented by obsessing, he will sooner or later be hurled out of his astral body into hell. But when that day comes he or she will no longer be a child, probably not in years, certainly not in spiritual development. Thus you see how it comes about that there are no children in hell. J. W. But there are vicious children of 5 or 6. H. J. L. Not many. They may be spoilt, thoughtless, and selfish, but there are few who are really vicious. Further, they too will realize the wickedness of their faults on coming over and seeing them visualize, as we all do. If not sufficiently spiritual to pass straight on to us, they will remain on the astral plane and they'll learn wisdom. If, however, they do not learn wisdom, they will learn folly, but even that will take time to work out its full course. And only when they have become too gross and wicked for the astral plane will they drop to hell. They will have ceased to be children when that happens. But it is seldom that a young child does grow worse on the astral plane. They nearly all improve, and, moreover, the bulk of young children are too spiritual to remain even there, but come almost at once either to the elementary schools in the trop division of hell or else to us. But here's the officer. Chapter 32. Of animals, and how they converse with men, transvision and conversation. June 1, 1914. I found myself floating over my body, and then began to whirl away into space. I seemed to pass through the ceiling into the open air, but yet was able to look right into my bedroom. Then the room became misty and vanished. I seemed to be whirling on and on amid clouds and mists, and it seemed a long journey. But at length the mists began to take form. At first these were fantastic in shape, some like castles and cliffs, others like dragons and monsters, then fairy cities, minarets, and cupolas. At length these vanished, and, as the mists rolled away, I saw a vast landscape stretching away beneath me. First I saw high mountains and arid deserts, and, beyond these, a great wall of darkness. I appeared to be traveling away from this wall of darkness, and gradually the landscape became less forbidding. The rocky mountains became clothed with forests, the deserts covered with grass. By degrees it developed into the beautiful country I now knew so well, bathed in that curious evening glow. Concentrating my mind on Old Queen's College, I seemed to increase the speed of my flight. Almost for a moment I found myself actually in H.J. L.S. room. "Oh, boss," I said, "what do animals, such as fowl, which spend their whole life on earth hunting for food, do on this plane?" "They can have no occupation," he replied. "While they are on the astral plane, most animals still endeavor to get food. They go on grubbing about for it, and it is only by degrees that they learn that any food they appear to find is but a delusion, and that, in fact, they do not need it. Once that stage is reached, the animal generally passes on to this plane. Many animals, such as most of the carnivora, seem quite unable to learn this lesson, and remain on the astral plane still hunting astral deer, which they never catch." J. W. "Are there men who go on hunting animals which they never catch?" H. J. L. "Yes, there are even fox hunters, horses and all. But sooner or later they weary of the empty sham, for they never catch anything. Usually, however, the tables are reversed, and the hunter upon earth becomes the hunted there. Man is back in the primitive world without the aid of weapons, and again is liable to the life of fear which our early ancestors suffered. Not till he has learnt the great secret, the power of the human will, is he again free from that fear. But you must remember that the type of man who runs foul of the astral animals is the man who has hunted them on earth. All men don't have exactly the same experiences on the astral plane, any more than they do on this plane. When the animals reach this plane, they have done so because they have other interests besides eating. At times they still cast back and feebly hunt round. I know occasionally Molly misses a bone, just as I do my pipe." J. W. "Why, there is Molly." And as I spoke, Molly emerged from under a sofa and came up to me, wagging her tail in quite a friendly way. H. J. L. continued, "Animals here become far more closely attached to us than they ever do on Earth. They certainly understand us better, and this compensates for the loss of more material amusements. You see, as we can perceive each other's thoughts, so we can, though to a lesser extent, perceive the animals' thoughts. They, too, visualize, but the difference lies in this: the average animal, not having learned to think clearly, as we have, can only visualize a muddled sort of idea. But they tend to improve. Of course their ideas, at the best, are very simple. Still, it creates a bond of sympathy which is largely absent on Earth. Now just look at Molly's thought." I, J. W., looked intently, but could perceive nothing at first. "I can't see anything. Perhaps she is not thinking of anything in particular." H. J. L. "On the contrary, she is thinking very deeply for a dog. That's why I thought you'd be able to see it, though, of course, you have not had any practice in developing that faculty. However, try again. Empty your mind of all personal thoughts and concentrate it on Molly. Fix your eyes on the tip of her nose." I laughed at the last sentence, but followed all his instructions. After a moment the whole room seemed to fade away, including even the dog herself, and in its place was a kind of light which grew into a picture similar to the clairvoyant pictures one sees in the crystal. And then I saw Carrie sitting in the boat at Weybridge, and Molly herself seated in the prow. The boat moved out of the boathouse into the river, and Carrie, who was wearing a white jersey, was rowing. There was no one else in the boat. Then the vision changed, and I saw Molly and Carrie seated in the garden at Weybridge. Tea was brought out, and Molly proceeded to lie down for a piece of cake. Then H. J. L.S. voice broke in, "Well, Jack, you could see her thoughts that time?" J. W. "Yes, but how did you know I could?" H. J. L. "Because I could see both your thoughts and hers, and they corresponded. We get fairly expert in reading people's thoughts here, but of course you are new to it." "Well, I think that answers your question fairly well. You can easily understand that the more closely associated with man an animal is, the more it will develop. The more it develops, the more complicated will be the ideas which it will be able to remember or understand, and so communication between men and animals will become easier. For example, that thought of Molly's was fairly complicated. Many animals would have managed nothing more than a face of their mistress. If we wish to communicate an idea to an animal, we have to think of some very simple idea. Now watch. I'm going to think of Blanche." At once Molly jumped up and wagged her tail, and I perceived she was looking at the boss. Between both of them appeared a vision of Blanche about 2 years old, but whereas H. J. L. saw her in the garden at L. Molly only saw B. with no particular background. I knew this because Blanche stood out very clearly, while the garden at L. was much fainter, and I knew, by instinct, that this was because Molly had grasped the idea of Blanche, but not the more complicated idea of at L. Then it vanished, and H. J. L. said, "Yes, she got the first idea all right, but not did grasp that I meant at L. I dare say if you were to think of her at G, she'd grasp that all right. The remembrance of G, in connection with Blanche, would be so much clearer to her." I tried, and at once Molly got very excited, jumped up on her hind legs, and began to walk towards me. At the same time I saw the vision of Blanche on the tennis lawn at G, and the background was nearly, though not quite, as clear as Blanche. In short, Molly had perceived practically the whole idea I had desired to convey. Then it faded again, and Molly retired once more under the sofa. H. J. L. "How high the most intelligent animals can travel with us I can't say, but you will see that there are possibilities of development for them here lacking on Earth. Of course, by telepathy even on Earth, animals are often able to read our thoughts to a limited extent. But it is generally in the matter of the cruder passions, such as fear of them or dislike. Further, they are often helped even in these cases by involuntary movements of our own. I think, however, that we've said enough on this subject for tonight. If you think over carefully what I have just told you, you will realize its importance more fully. If, then, any point requires further elucidation, why, ask me again. J. W. Thanks. By the by, how are we communicating now? We appear to be talking. L. By telepathy. Our minds, used to the idea of talking, translate it into words, but of course we do not actually use words here. You would perceive the force of this at once if you were communicating with a Frenchman. To him you would appear to be talking in French, to you he would seem to be speaking in English. It is only when we get onto the earth plane and try to communicate through a medium that we have to employ actual language. Then, if we wished to speak to foreigners and did not know the language, we should have to learn it. This can be done, but I do not propose to go into exactly how just at the present moment. When we perceive each other's thoughts, our minds turn this perception into sight. Both are related to telepathy, but, for the sake of distinction, we can correlate perception of visions with clairvoyance. We can employ either method for communicating. With men, telepathy is slightly the easier, it seems to require less will exertion. With animals, however, I find the vision is the best method, probably because they have never spoken on Earth. But of course both methods merge. Even in your own case, when the officer has been telling you his adventures, you have at times not merely heard, but seen what he went through. W. Yes, that is so, though, when writing these visits down, I had not realized it. Well, you will realize it now. Here comes the officer. The officer, having finished his narrative, went out. H. J. L.